Welcome to Spiritual Onion, where today we're looking at the impact loss has on our life and who and what we love. The previous podcast ended with the very real challenge of keeping our hearts open in the face of life's trials and tribulations. Doing the work of keeping our hearts open as we hold and engage our inner soulful and spiritual energies. Perhaps the greatest difficulty in keeping our hearts open is our ongoing experience of loss. If we do not face the fact that life includes a never-ending series of losses, then we risk becoming bitter and resentful as life inexorably pushes us forward. This struggle was brought home recently when Deb and I had to put to sleep our 15-year-old Maltese. I am intrigued about our language here. We put down a pet, or we put our pet to sleep. I guess it seems too real to say we had her put to death, or God forbid, too brutal to say we had her killed. That sounds terrible. Do we avoid any whiff of the word death in favor of softer words that avoid the stark reality of loss? Hannah was a rescue. When we lived in Illinois, we drove into darkest Iowa to get her. She had been in a series of foster homes after her aging owner could no longer care for her. As we walked into the foster home, Hannah started an endless series of rapid-fire jumps, leading Deb to exclaim, "She's so peppy." The phrase became a running joke. Hannah was an anxious little girl. Like an amphetamine-fueled wild woman, she would corncob my forearm, so-called because it was just like she was munching down the rows on an ear of corn. For the first few months, Deb would put her to sleep by singing Puff the Magic Dragon. Her eyes would blink and blink and blink, then slowly close. A kinder, gentler dog you could not find. In nearly 15 years, we never heard her growl at either dog or human. She had a sweet disposition and a loving heart. One downside, though, was that she was so food-motivated. Give her a treat and she would just about take off your fingers. We gave her a treat when she came in the house after peeing. But oh boy, was she smart. Soon she would go out the front and back door without doing a thing, yet come in demanding a treat. You might think that would be easy to manage, just don't give her a treat, right? Wrong. She was an incessant barker. She had no trouble barking her head off until she got her treat. Deb and I spent years trying to decipher her barks because, as far as we could discern, they all sounded pretty much alike. Since her death, the house is quiet. There remains an empty space that she once inhabited. Her loss is palpable. In the evening, when she would bark until we made the move to go to bed, there now is silence. Am I missing her maddening bark? Well, kinda. So let's use Hannah's death as a jumping-off point to think about life, love, and loss. We only experience deep loss when we invest deeply in life. Only those who know how to die know how to live. Unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. So the fear of loss and death, conscious or unconscious, can hold us back from investing in life, can hold us back from fully living. Deb deeply experiences Hannah's loss because they were joined at the proverbial hip. Hannah would sit at the front storm door, patiently gazing down the street for Deb's return. Now that image causes Deb sorrow. Picking up on the last podcast, loss and death are soulful experiences. We cannot rise above in the spirit when we are impacted by loss unless we fall up into cliches. She's in a better place. Hannah's in doggy heaven. God must have needed another lapdog. No, sorrow, suffering, loss, grief, and death exist in the shadows. They bring us down into the depths, the valley of the shadow of death, the abyss of loss, and yet a soulful place. If we look at one of the first stories in Jewish and Christian scripture, we find the Hebrew people struggling with these very issues. Throughout the profound drama in the Garden of Eden, the people are trying to come to grips with the experience of loss. The book of Genesis recounts that man and woman live in the paradise of unified consciousness, untouched by the conflict of opposites. This unified consciousness is shattered by the eating of the apple from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and the resultant dualistic consciousness. They now know how to split reality into opposites, good and evil, skinny and fat, right and wrong, hot and cold, and on. Any nuance goes right out the window, a binary lens for life, to be sure. And it gets worse. This dualistic or binary way of seeing divides the world into those who are for us and those who are against us. Purity codes separate those who are clean and those who are unclean, those who are in and those who are out. We distinguish between those who belong and those who do not belong, the saints and the sinners. Making comparisons becomes the way of the world. We come to know separation, alienation, isolation, estrangement, and fear. The garden story is an attempt to understand the place of loss in each of our lives. Loss of connection with God, loss of connection with others, loss of connection with nature, loss of connection with our very own souls. We are naked, exposed, and ashamed of our very flesh, ashamed of being seen. The story ends with God placing an angel armed with a flaming sword at the entrance of the garden, letting us know there is no returning to paradise. There is no going back. Paradise with God and unified consciousness have been lost. Faith is not for overcoming our losses. It is for experiencing them all the way through. The only way is through. Along with that, we experience seeing just a part rather than the whole of reality. Experience is now governed by categories, a continual process of dividing reality. Richard Rohr tells us that dualistic thinking works well for the sake of simplification and conversation, but not for the sake of truth or the immense subtlety of actual personal experience. Most of us settle for quick and easy answers instead of any deep perception, which we leave to poets, philosophers, and prophets. Yet depth and breadth of perception should be the primary arena for all authentic religion. How else could we possibly search for God? He continues, "We do need the dualistic mind to function in practical life, however, and to do our work as a teacher, a nurse, a scientist, or an engineer. It's helpful and fully necessary as far as it goes, but it just doesn't go far enough. The dualistic mind cannot process things like infinity, mystery, God, grace, suffering, sexuality, death, or love. This is exactly why most people stumble over these very issues. The dualistic mind pulls everything down into some kind of tit-for-tat system of false choices and two simple contraries, which is largely what fast food religion teaches, usually without even knowing it. Without the contemplative and converted mind, honest and humble perception, much religion is frankly dangerous." With dualistic thinking, we get an either-or perspective, debating, arguing. Becoming defensive about our limited perspective is our stance in the world. So often, we are not even listening to the other person. Instead, we are preparing our next thought, our next argument. Our ego is front and center, slicing and dicing our way through life. As long as we remain trapped in dualistic thinking, we will remain in the psychological space of separation and alienation. We will be unable to make connections with people who hold the supposed wrong point of view. That is, one that is different from ours. Rather than experiencing the other as an interesting someone, we remain disconnected because the other is of a different race, class, gender, sexual orientation, political perspective, religious background, ancestral heritage, and so on. You're either with me or against me. Instead, a both-and perspective allows us to be better able to enter into dialogue rather than debate. Employing empathy allows us to disconnect from our ego in order to think and feel our way into another person's wholeness. What if they are neither good nor bad, but just different? Different from our usual way of being or doing. The world then becomes less threatening, more enlivening, a curious place to be. A middle ground allows us to keep our hearts open to the nuances, distinctions, and otherness of the person before us. Traditional Christianity is trapped in this same dualistic thinking. God and Satan, heaven and hell, moral and immoral, the saved and unsaved, the sheep and the goats, those who belong to our religious group and those who don't. This explains why visiting an unfamiliar religious community is so painful. Everyone there knows we do not belong, and almost everyone is uncomfortable with greeting the stranger. Everybody turns to someone they know. In one of my annual reports to my bishop, I wrote that I had built friendships with two pastors from very different religious perspectives than mine. His response was that he was curious about my experience because Lutherans don't usually associate with those religious groups. You got that right. If we are to escape this dualistic and deadly religious perspective, we must experience an ongoing loss. Our childhood image of God must die if we are to grow in spiritual awareness. This childhood God image is a small and simple God, but many still cling to it. Our personal experience of the divine will include a terrible defeat and loss for the ego. In order for the presence of God to become more real to us, the ego must undergo various experiences of dying and loss. Without this ego death, God remains a projection of our desires. God is someone who supports the ego's desire for more of everything, health, wealth, avoidance of suffering, the one who is to answer our egocentric prayers. Each time our God image matures, we experience a painful absence of that sacred as we await the return of a more complex and complicated image of God. We lose this simplistic and unhelpful universe where good and evil are painted in black and white colors. An adolescent perspective, to be sure. With each loss of any kind, our world changes. And staying aware of this is a challenge. One day I was taking my two sons to dinner and one of them used the term BD. I asked, "What is BD?" They answered that BD was before divorce and AD was after divorce. A way to think and speak about how their world had been changed forever by the loss of the divorce. One of Freud's most important essays is called On Mourning and Melancholia, or Grief and Depression. Left to its own genius, the soul has the capacity to grieve. After the loss of a beloved person, pet, place, or life dream, we can trust our ability to endure the hurt and pain of a loss. but it means keeping our heart open to the experience of loss. In terms of the loss of a person, the initial grieving takes at least a year. We must experience holidays and special days where we experience the absence of the presence of this beloved person. At least a year in processing thoughts, ideas, projections, attachments, and feelings connected to the deceased. And beyond that, we will feel the loss again as we hear a deceased person's favorite song, or see someone who looks like them, or something triggers a memory for us. Grief and grieve comes from a Latin word meaning heavy, weighty, connected to the weightiness of suffering. What complicates grief in our day is that we usually are not supported in taking time to grieve. In so-called primitive cultures, the grieving person would be removed from the daily tasks and roles to focus on grieving. Members of the village would put that person at the edge of the village and tend to the person by providing food and carrying out their daily tasks. In this way, a person could grieve for a year and then return to the village, restored and renewed. What about our day? We get a funeral and 3 days off from work, having then the task of tending to our grief in and amongst the daily responsibilities. So it takes energy, focused effort, and support to be able to grieve while doing life. In grief, we may feel as though we have lost part of ourselves. This happens when the person was someone who really got us, who could see us for who we are and reflect us back to ourselves. The deceased may have strengthened our sense of self because together we understood a common human experience in a particularly deep way. Or the deceased may have been someone we could turn to in times of trouble, when we needed a shoulder to cry on, when we needed the experience of a wise and spiritually strong person. When this is the case, we will feel less well put together. We will feel vulnerable and have a hard time keeping ourselves together. A few years ago, my therapist died. I had worked with Tom over the course of almost 2 decades, so his death was a profound loss. After his loss, I went through a particularly rough time, and I found myself thinking, I need to call Tom. And then I would remember he was no longer in the world. His loss left a giant hole in my world. Yet, as I grieved his loss, I came to recognize that it was possible to turn inward to Tom and find his wisdom that now resided in me. When we are not given the opportunity to grieve, a number of potential problems can arise. One problem is seen through the example of a woman who came to me in therapy. Her first husband had died in a traumatic situation early on in their marriage, and after a number of years, she married a second time to a man who adored her. After decades in this second marriage, she came to realize that she had never fully or truly loved this man because her heart was still attached to her dead first husband. It was a complex grieving. The end goal of grieving is to accept the loss, detach from the lost person, realize fully that that person is not in the world in order to reinvest in life. So we had to work through the grief that had been buried for many years. Grief can be complicated if we had a complex or negative relationship with the deceased. We may feel guilty in acknowledging how many negative feelings we have toward the person. We may still carry loads of anger, sorrow, resentment, and bitterness over what we did not receive from the deceased. In the latest edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the natural process of grieving has been subsumed under the heading of depression. This has led to grieving persons being prescribed antidepressants, grieving is now seen as pathological. This conflating of grief and depression leaves persons confused about the natural process of grieving, and antidepressants can bury the very feelings we need to process in order to fully return to life. It is true, grief and depression can look quite similar. With both, we can have a change of eating and sleep patterns. We can experience apathy in life, lose energy, and so on. Pain accompanies both grief and depression. In grief, the world appears impoverished because the loved one is no longer there. In depression, the ego has become diminished. The depressed person belittles themselves, speaks of themselves in terms of disdain, feeling unworthy of someone else's love. The psyche splits. One part criticizes and humiliates the other part, causing the person to feel lonely, unhappy, guilty of all sorts of misery. Religion can do us harm if we are meant to feel as though we should not mourn because our loved one has gone on to be with Jesus, or we are instructed that grief and faith cannot go together. If we were really faithful, we would not be profoundly affected by loss, right? The Dalai Lama once mentored an extremely talented and spiritual monk. Then this young man committed suicide. Years later, in an interview, the Dalai Lama was asked, "How did you get over this monk's death?" And the Dalai Lama replied, "What makes you think I have gotten over his death?" When we experience traumatic loss of any kind, we have the monumental task of carrying our grief, bearing the weight in one form or another for the rest of our lives. It takes a long time for the psyche to find a place to put traumatic loss. And so here we have to be kind and patient with ourselves. Once, when I was interviewing for acceptance in a training program, the interviewers ask about the significant losses in my life. I thought for a moment and then answered, "There is a river of sorrow flowing deep within me, but it is from this place that I do my work, my therapeutic work, a double-edged sword, no doubt." Let me conclude with a few random thoughts and then a poem by D.H. Lawrence. Consider just how much accompanies our life cycle. It begins with birth, where we lose the unified consciousness and paradise of our mother's womb. Think about going to school on that first day, or moving from your first home and neighborhood, perhaps moving to another city. There's a loss when a sibling is born. And for men, many feel a loss with the birth of a first child, as though their wife is no longer there for them. We have the loss of each grandparent, the loss of pets. Hannah is the fourth dog that has passed on. We have the loss of our physical health along the way, the loss of a job or a career. We could have divorce. Graduations remove us from favorite friends, teachers, and a particular stage of life. We have the loss of the death in aunts and uncles and parents. We have retirement. Add to the list from your own experience. For self-identified Christians, I think our resistance to the profound process of loss and grief is reflected in our response to the three great days of Holy Week. On Good Friday, there is hardly anyone in church. In fact, I know that one of the largest mega churches in Pittsburgh does not even hold a Good Friday service. Perhaps it's too depressing. And few churches hold a Holy Saturday service. Who wants to contemplate Jesus in the tomb? Talk about a downer. But boy, we turn out in our Sunday best for Easter, don't we? New clothes, Easter lilies, a bunch of upbeat hymns, and brunch. Forget the pain and pass the potatoes. But we cannot avoid the truth that any new life is always preceded by loss. I can't remember the streaming show we were watching, but there was this great line, "Grief is love with nowhere to go." Becomes our task to grieve until our love can reinvest in the world. If we don't do our grief work, the losses pile up in the psyche. You know this is true when a new loss pulls up unfinished business from past losses. So do the work now or pay the price later. As Jung writes, whatever we don't face only makes us ill. Since I'm in my last stage of life, I know experientially I am grieving all of life's possibilities that I did not follow. Choosing one path cuts off other paths, and at my age, this entails in grieving what could never be. Closure is a fantasy, especially built for people who love control and like things wrapped up with a ribbon or bow. Life is loss, plain and simple. We must learn to grieve along with living. We must learn to carry our grief. We have to afford psyche the opportunity to find a place to put our losses. It's an ongoing process without end. And then finally, we all lose it all. I don't know experientially what lies ahead, but I do know how much I will miss this strange world of sorrow, this world of soul-making. And now a poem, The Ship of Death by D.H. Lawrence. Have you built your ship of death, or have you? Oh, build your ship of death, for you will need it. Now in the twilight, sit by the invisible sea of peace and build your little ship of death that will carry your soul on its last journey, on and on, so still, so beautiful, over the last of seas. When the day comes, that will come. Oh, think of it in the twilight peacefully. The last day, and the setting forth on the longest journey over the hidden sea to the last wonder of oblivion. Oblivion, the last wonder. When we have trusted ourselves entirely to the unknown and are taken up out of our little ships of death into pure oblivion. Oh, build your ship of death. Be building it now with dim, calm thoughts and quiet hands, putting its timbers together in the dusk, rigging its mast with the silent, invisible sail that will spread in death to the breeze of the kindness of the cosmos, that will waft the little ship with its soul to the wonder goal. Ah, if you want to live in peace on the face of the earth, then build your ship of death in readiness for the longest journey over the last of seas. If you've listened before, we always end our podcast with a song. This week, the band combines Long Black Veil, which is a traditional American folk song, with Keep Me in Your Heart by Warren Zevon, songs of grief and loss. Zevon recorded his song when he was dying of lung cancer, forcing him to record his vocals in short phrases because of his difficulty in breathing. I'll be back in a couple weeks with a podcast on dreams called Dream Me Awake. My friends, grieve well.
10 years ago, on a cold, dark night, there was some. Somewhere else, then you won't have to. father's headed north, north to Pleasant Stream.